Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. Today we hear from Ron Kaufman. We thought it would be good right after the midterm elections to hear from someone who has a lot of campaign experience. We interviewed Ron on Friday, right after the midterm elections, in the Washington headquarters of the Dentons Law Firm. Dentons is the largest law firm on the planet, actually. Ron is a senior advisor there in public policy and regulation. He focuses on providing government affairs services to public and private sector clients. We hear about his White House job in the personnel office. We hear about his White House job as political director. We hear about all the campaigns that he has worked on. He was with H.W. Bush in 1980, worked on that campaign, and then worked on his successful 88 presidential campaign. He is very close to Mitt Romney, worked on his presidential campaigns, and he has many, many, many great political stories. So I hope you enjoy the interview. We are sitting here today on K Street in downtown Washington, D.C. with Ron Kaufman, the senior advisor in public policy and regulation for Dentons. It is the Friday after the election, and we're going to ask Ron, or I'm going to ask him right now. So Ron, what does divided government mean for, or the election mean for you and your clients here at Dentons?
Well, first of all, divided government is what the founding fathers thought gave us the best democracy. You know, the history of, I think, a great and wonderful country, we get the best governing, I think, by having divided government. Results on Tuesday still aren't totally clear, other than the Democrats are obviously going to control the House and will control the Senate. And we have the White House. So it will make it for an interesting couple years. But I think the net of it all is that we'll get better governing out of it. If you look at, Jim, the freshman class, the 70-odd freshman class on the Democratic side in particular, it's very diverse. And as a Republican, I'm jealous a little bit. But I think it's good for the country. It clearly was a shows you what's going on in the country as a whole, where the red really is in the rural and in the Midwest, mid part of the country, and the Democrats really have got a toehold in the cities and in the urban surrounding counties. And historically, meaning since Eisenhower, the Democrats have been the party of Congress, and we've been the party of the executive in the Senate, more than the House. So I think it's going back to kind of more historic roots, if you will, that right now it's about where it usually is, where we control the White House and maybe the Senate, and they control the House. And we're going to have to learn to play nice together. And I think I was very impressed listening to a lot of the freshmen, both Republicans and Democrats, who said, listen, we're getting elected to make things happen. Not to try to play hard, not try to impose investigations, etc. We want to get things done. And I'd be very interested to see what happens. It'd be a very good sign if the first thing out of the box next year is an infrastructure bill that everybody can agree upon. It'd be good for everyone, including our clients. But it's the right thing to do. Interestingly, I think if we had done that, the Republicans had done that at the beginning 2 years ago of the last Congress, it would have set a better tone for everything. So tonally, I think we're going to be in good shape.
So, Ron, for those that don't work in Washington, D.C., how do you spend your time advising and working with your clients?
A lot of time talking, shockingly. Having been in politics, I kind of enjoy doing that, obviously. And having been in Washington now, you know, it's funny, Jim. You ask people in this town, where are you from? You say, oh, I'm from Boston. Oh, good. How long have you been in Washington? 47 years. Yeah. People don't admit that.
Yes, nobody's from here.
So I'm from Boston. Go Sox. So I spent, but I've been blessed. I've never worked the Hill officially, but I have a lot of friends who have worked the Hill. A lot of members are friends, and you know, I work mostly in the White House and in the executive branch. And because of that, I've had a unique view. I ran personnel for 41, as we call it.
Yes.
George Herbert Walker Bush. And having to have to put government together, you have to understand how it works. So that knowledge has been very helpful to me in my clients and the firm's clients. So I tend to be, now that I'm kind of been here since Abe Lincoln, I do more advising
helping them come up with how to approach the government
right,
and the issues.
And the best way to do it. And you know, people come in and they say, I've got this problem, and we want to talk to the president about it, or the secretary about it. And you have to understand the town to understand sometimes the worst thing you can do for a client is get a meeting with the congressman or the senator or the secretary or the assistant secretary or the president or whoever.
And why is that?
Because they're going to give you a good meeting. They're going to nod appropriately, especially if they happen to be friends and glad to meet your client, and it's wonderful, and I'll listen closely. And after the meeting, if they're impressed, it's okay. You have to go see Johnny Jones, or the who's my assistant working on this area.
Yep.
Or when you leave, they'll ask Johnny Jones, what do you think about this particular problem and what they have to say? You're much wiser making sure that you know how the system works, know the people that the principal relies on that area of expertise, and talk to them first, educate them first. So when the principal turns his head or her head and talks to the appropriate assistant on that area, they're already prepped to say, well, they have a really good idea, or they have a really good solution, or whatever it may be. And that's a better way to handle...
Better way to approach it. It's not the first time the staff person is hearing it and doesn't get resentful.
And the principal who will give you a nice meeting, usually one bite at that apple at that level.
Right.
When they turn around, it's already kind of done.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
But I understand people from the outside who just don't understand that, and they want to meet the secretary.
And we've heard this before. You spend time educating your clients. They come up, they'll say, Ron, I think we should do X, and you say, well, what are you trying to accomplish here? And you educate your clients and really map out a better plan for them.
Absolutely.
And okay.
The truth is, if they don't want it that way, that's great, but then we can't really help them. And you got to be able to say no to a client. You know, it's so different than advising.
And you do that?
You know, all the time.
Okay.
And fire clients. I used to represent remember during Katrina, right after Katrina?
Yes.
Some great friends of mine from New Orleans asked me to come down and represent Mayor Nagin and help him in Washington and get to know Washington. So I went down like 2 days after the hurricane, and it was so interesting. And met with Mayor Nagin and my friends and really liked him. You always loved Ray Nagin the first time you meet him. After that, so anyway. I said, well, here's the way. If you're really serious, Ray, about getting a lot of help in Washington, a lot of people, including the White House and others, will want to help you. But you've got to understand what that means. You've got to agree that there are certain things that, at the end of the day, you can't rebuild certain places because it's not going to work. And a lot of Republicans in particular aren't going to give you money if that money is going to be wasted on things that don't fix long-term your city. And absolutely. And after 2 weeks, we had a split company because he was all over the place asking about all kinds of things that wouldn't help the city, particularly long-term. And I knew Washington would help him.
Before we talk about your time at the White House, and let's go back to your first political campaign. What was your first political experience?
Well, Abe Lincoln was a heck of a guy. I was running supermarkets, Jim, in Boston, and a friend of mine wanted to run for governor in 1982, and this was 1977. And between the two of us, we had 43 cents. And we agreed that we should help someone run for president in 80 in Massachusetts, to use somebody else's money to build an organization in Massachusetts to help my friend run for governor. And so we looked at all the candidates, and there were 16 candidates in 80. And long story short, we fell in love with this guy named George Herbert Walker Bush. He was born in Milton, Mass, so he was a Mass native, although he lived there like for 4 days. He wanted to be close to his mother, I guess. He had a great organizational sense of politics. And in that cycle, the 1980 cycle, always Iowa first, New Hampshire second,
yep.
And Massachusetts was third. So
okay.
This is important. And we thought about going with Reagan, but we've had two young punks from Massachusetts who would never get close to Ronald Reagan, and he would never take Massachusetts seriously. And again, we met Bush and fell in love, and no one wanted me because I was wrapping letters for a living, but my young friend was a bright young state rep that everyone thought was the future. So everyone wanted to be chairman. We joined the Bush campaign, and we had a great time, and we won Iowa. Bush didn't remember in 80, beat Reagan, so we're on a roll. We're like, and then we lost New Hampshire, and we're downward spiral, and we end up winning Massachusetts by 1,000 votes.
Wow.
Then I went on the national team, and the rest is history. Anyway, we won Massachusetts. I went on the national team, and I was in four states, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and Michigan.
Okay.
The only four primaries that Bush won. And then time ran out, and then Jim Baker said, well, I don't know if you're any good or you're just really lucky, but either way, stay in politics. And I end up going to the RNC and be a regional political director, then the national political director. Then in 84, I ran Bush's reelection campaign as vice president.
Yep.
Then in 88, in the primary, I ran New Hampshire.
Right.
And then the general election, my job was to go back to Boston and drive the caucus crazy.
Dukakis
would tell you, yeah, I overachieved in that one. And then we go in the White House, and I ran the inaugural. And then
So having you pause there for a moment.
Sure.
So in the 88 campaign, so wait, who was your friend? You said Jim?
Oh, no, my friend, a guy you probably never heard of, Andy Card.
Oh, Andy. Oh, sure.
He ended up being my brother-in-law also.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And
so it was and Andy putting this together in Massachusetts. Okay.
Yeah.
And then in 88, Bush lost Iowa?
We won Iowa, lost New Hampshire.
Okay, and so in 88, when he became president,
yes,
did he lose or win Iowa?
Came in third. And we won New Hampshire.
And then he comes to New Hampshire and he wins.
Yeah,
so it's critical that year.
Yes.
And you're back running New Hampshire, helping oversee that.
In 88.
In 88.
Correct, yeah.
And that was a critical win.
It was a fun win.
And then he went on to get the nomination.
Right.
And the 88 presidential campaign, what was that like? By this time, you've been with him for 8 years, a supporter. And all I've heard about, sorry to interrupt you, in 1980, I heard that he worked harder than anybody in the field, that he went to thousands of events
In 80?
In 80.
Yeah. 80 was a great campaign because everyone was working for then Ambassador Bush. Was there for any other reason other than they fell in love with him? His slogan was, a man we won't have to train. And because of his background, you know, he'd done everything.
CIA director.
CIA, ambassador. Congress, ambassador,
yep.
And done it well.
Yep.
And we all fell in love with him, man. And it was a small ragtag army, and we had a great time. It's always the best campaign of my life. And we were disappointed, of course, then became the vice president, I went back with him, and the rest of the history again. But 88 was a little different because we were the front runner going in.
Yes.
And then we got creamed in Iowa. Came in third, a sitting vice president. So it made New Hampshire
critical.
Really important. And winning that we were behind by Dole for a while, but we came back and did well. And the rest is kind of history.
And for those people who haven't worked on a presidential campaign, what is it? It must be, what is that like? In 88, you were working on that campaign at a pretty high level.
The truth is, as I mentioned earlier, after the 80 cycle, I went to the RNC.
Right.
But starting in 81, on my own, without any real authority, once every month, I'd go to New Hampshire. It was in my area anyway, but I went to New Hampshire and talked with people about George Bush. So quietly, I spent 7 years
building
putting pieces,
that goodwill
putting
up.
A little team in New Hampshire that wow. held together. Anyway, it was fun. It was great. It's like war, though. It's like
yeah.
a band of brothers. There's almost no difference. You make friends for life.
Yep.
We slept in the 88. The headquarters was a condemned building that literally I slept in. You know, upstairs in this creaky old couch every, and we just loved it. It was a blast.
That's great.
Yeah.
And so after the 88 campaign, you go into the White House.
I ran the inaugural.
Okay.
Which is another different kind of war.
Why is that?
Well, it cost about $50 million. Anyway, think about it. It starts the day after the election.
Yep.
Ends the day of the inauguration.
Yep.
And you got to put together the planning, hire the people, put on events, you know, of all kinds, spend $50 million.
And you have a lot of important people that have to be treated correctly.
Yeah, so everyone's a VIP.
You're right.
And they do it all out right, and then close it all down in a week. So it's a different kind of experience. But I must admit, it's fun. They went to the White House, and I did personnel, which is another, where you have 100,000 people applying for jobs, and you've got, the president only has about 3,500 full-time slots.
Okay.
It sounds like, you know, that's, think about like Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, right?
Yes.
Back then, Social Security was part of it, you know, so you had like 250,000 employees with more offices than McDonald's. So but if you have a schematic of the flow chart of the department, I think we had 100 political appointees from the secretary to the secretaries.
Okay.
Right? And the idea was you had to take these 100 people and put them in the right place in this 250,000 person operation. And so when the president and the secretary make a decision, you can make that army go in the direction that you want to take them in.
Gets implemented.
Yeah. And so those 100 people become very important, right? And who are they? Well, it was the Reagan-Bush administration first. So people had those jobs, said, well, we're part of the Reagan-Bush administration. We want to stay here. And then you had people who worked in the campaign and said, well, we want those slots. And then you had people who were in the state said, well, we'd like to have those slots. And then our friends on the Hill, our dear friends on the Hill, said, well, I've got a great staffer who knows healthcare really well. And so it's a kind of a, and you hire a secretary to be the secretary of HHS.
Right.
And the first thing you tell them, listen, we'll fill this 100 people for you. You're not going to decide who's going to be there. We will.
Yep.
How does that all work? Somehow it does. It's the greatness of our democracy. It works relatively well.
And with a new president, it starts all over again.
Starts all over again. I'll tell you the one thing, as a Republican, growing up, you're always beat on the bureaucracy. It's bloated. It's too big. The one thing I did learn from my experience in personnel, as a country, we're blessed with a ton of bright, articulate, smart people who are in public service for all the right reasons. And you know, their job is to do what the marching orders say, and sometimes it's 180 degrees difference. And I'm just, I walked away really impressed with the amount of how lucky we are. And also found out they're great allies because they hated, the good ones, hated the bloated bureaucracy more than we did almost. So they tend to, even though mostly Democrats, they tend to like Republican administrations better than Democrat administrations. Just say it.
How long were you in that job for?
2.5 years, and then I became the political director.
So you filled all the jobs, and now you go over to the political director, which is a critical job for a president.
Re-election. How did we do? Not well.
Well, and what was that job like?
Different entirely. In the White House, being a political director, this depends upon the administration.
Okay.
Every administration is different, how they handle it. There are three kind of ways a president thinks about his political top folks. One is inside. You have a political director, and they run the political operation. Sometimes they'll put it, top people will be at the RNC or the DNC. Lee Atwater is a good example.
Yep.
He was a top person for Bush in 88,
yep.
And he decided to work out of the RNC, as chairman of the RNC. Sometimes it's like James Carville for Clinton. He chose to stay in the private sector. and be the power from the private sector.
Yep.
You know, and sometimes Lynn Lossinger for Reagan was the first political director ever.
Inside.
Yep. So three different ways.
Yep.
So the key is, if you're the political director for the president, there's lots of different parts of your job. One part is president's time. How, you know, does he campaign for this congressman or that congressman, this senator, that senator? How much time, how much effort do you give to the RNC or the congressional committee, the senatorial committee? You know, everybody wants his time. You know, you gotta start raising some money, and that, so that's all kind of, who sees him, who rides on the plane, who rides in the limousine, all that kind of, I call it the body politics.
Yep.
Important part of the job, very important part of the job. Anything that touches politics crosses your desk. But the fun part, really, and I was blessed, not everyone has the same seat, when we're making the important decisions, if the chief of staff has you at the table, you know, the staff table, to say, okay, we're thinking about cutting Social Security, which never happened, of course, and the chief of staff will say, okay, around the table, what is it? He'll ask the Secretary of HHS, what does this mean for you? What do you think? What are your thoughts? You know, how does that? And then he'll ask the president and head of the Congress, the Congressional Relations, how does it affect Congress? What are the chances? And then he'll ask me, the political person, what's the politics of this? Well, how will it affect us politically? So that's a seat that I felt blessed to have, to have a little input. And just one piece of a big wheel on how policy is actually decided for the president. So it's fun.
And I would imagine as you get closer to re-election, that job becomes even much more important, and you're spending a lot more time with the president.
It changes drastically because you then, in August of the year before the presidential campaign, you start the presidential campaign up.
Yep.
So you have another set of bosses, if you will, who think they're in charge over here.
Yeah.
So, you know, outside of the wild. Say the chief of staff, and you're used to playing this way, and all of a sudden you have outside.
Yeah.
And it depends how smoothly that goes, depends how well it goes. And
who ran the Bush reelection campaign?
Bob Teeter.
And at that time, who was chief of staff for the president?
First, John Sununu.
Yep.
And then Sam Skinner from Illinois.
Okay.
And then in the end, Jim Baker.
Okay.
Who is... I'm blessed. You're blessed with your friends, your family, and your mentors in life. And I'm blessed to be able to call Jim Baker a mentor.
He was a mentor.
Yeah, he's the guy who, after New Hampshire back in '80, said you should be on the team, so national team. So Jim, he's always been a great friend to me. And
now, what is it you hear great things about Jim Baker? What is it about him that you admire or like so much?
Lots of things. First of all, he's brilliant. That helps a lot.
Right.
Second of all, he understands politics better than the nuances. You know, he got his start. His first big break was running for Jerry Ford in the 76 convention, the convention. And if you remember, Ford was a Nixon-appointed vice president who became president.
Yes.
Then he pardoned Nixon, so his numbers were disastrous.
Yes.
And Ronald Reagan was the opponent in the primaries. And had actually going into the convention, had more delegates than Ford, although neither had enough to go over top. And the Baker-led team managed to end up winning overwhelmingly at the convention. And that started Jim Baker as being the person you want in your team. And his best friend was George Herbert Walker Bush.
Correct.
And we came within a couple inches of being the nominee in '80. You know,
right.
If we had held on in New Hampshire, it would have been President Bush, not President Reagan, I think.
In 1980.
Yeah, because of the genius. But he's just a really good manager. People, straightforward. You knew where you stood. He liked to make decisions, made them quickly, had great people around him. Like, great leaders have great people. You know, I think that's even more important sometimes than being the smartest guy in the room. Is be able to have the smartest people around in the room with you, and then have the wisdom to he liked diversity of thought.
Mm-hmm.
If we sat down with Mr. Baker at any one point in time and we all agreed, he'd say something's wrong here. You know, Mitt Romney's the same way, who's not great. And 41's the same way, where they love to have diversity at the table. They want you to disagree with him.
And they don't want yes men. They want a different opinion.
I guarantee
the other side.
If you want to throw out of a room with 41 or Mitt or Baker, be a yes man.
I remember one story about Jim Baker where his longtime assistant, was it Margaret?
Margaret Tutwiler.
Yes. Was advising a young aide, I can't remember who it was, who said, if Mr. Baker asks you for the weather, you better bring a weather map from NASA or whatever he said. And the aide was like, okay, got it. That he was very detail-oriented and would want a lot of information.
And Margaret Tutwiler, it was a friend, obviously, a good friend. She was great. She's what every great executive needs. She's what they call a clear filter, right? So if you're smart and you want to get a decision made from Jim Baker that didn't require meetings and stuff, you go to Margaret and say, Margaret, here's the problem. Here's what people are saying. And here's my advice. And you tell it to Margaret. She'd go to Jim Baker and say, Mr. Baker. She always called Mr. Baker. Mr. Baker. Ron says, here's the problem. Here's what the different folks are saying. Here's his advice. What do you want us to do? And he'd say it, and she'd come back and tell you, Mr. Baker says do this. And you knew that she was a clear filter. You knew she took what you said, gave it to him directly without any color, and he'd get back the answer without any color.
Is that what you mean by clear?
Clear filter.
No bias.
No bias. And
got it.
And even if she had strong feelings. Now, if Jim Baker asked her, well, Michael, what do you think? She'd tell him. But she was what reporters used to be, you know, clear filters and don't have anymore.
So if he didn't ask her, Mr. Baker didn't ask her opinion, she would just give it straight up
right.
as you gave it to her.
Yeah, but he trusted her judgment, and she could weigh in mm-hmm. if he wanted her to. But you never doubted, and it was like that. You know, you didn't have to wait a day. You didn't have to, almost within the hour. You get back to your desk, and there's a phone call from her saying, Jim says this or that. So that's the way it operated. Never believed you had to have a meeting more than a half an hour. So even the senior staff, he ran it like tight as a drum.
That's great.
It's great, yeah. I want to go back to the personnel stuff and say.
Yeah.
And say, the thing about being a personnel guy, you should hate it, you know. I didn't want to do it, and I was talked into it, bludgeoned into it by Atwater and the president.
Because, by the way, can I say something?
Sure.
When you said Atwater was the RNC, can you imagine Lee Atwater being inside the White House?
No.
All I can think of is that picture, the picture of his book, where he's got his sweatpants pulled down, he's wearing his shorts, and apparently Mrs. Bush, when she saw that, was not very pleased.
No comment. She's watching.
She's watching.
But I learned how government was put together. And everyone who got a job in the administration sat at my desk at one point or other. And I, you know, it was the hottest job I've ever had as far as, you know, I'd start at 5 in the morning and I'd leave at 1.
3,500 meetings. 3,500 people.
I wish it was only 3,500. That's the jobs you have. You have 100,000 applicants.
Wow.
Anyway, so the thing is, I learned so much about how government works at every level and every agency. So it helps me today in my career of trying to help people work their way through the government.
Yes, you've been on the inside. You see what it's... Yeah.
And you get to see where the false doors are and the one-way glass is. And
yeah.
It's helped a lot.
Yeah, I bet. I bet it has.
Yeah.
So when you leave as political director, you go out into business after that.
You've probably forgotten, Jim, we lost the election.
Well, I was trying to get through that without actually saying
well,
that.
The voters decided I'd been there long enough, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I did spend some time in the basement playing Pac-Man.
Well, actually, let's talk about that. I mean, I was trying to be, I can't imagine. What was it? I mean, here you are, you're, as you describe it, in a war for a year.
Yeah.
You're exhausted, and after the Iraq war, his approval ratings are at like 90%.
Yeah.
That quickly begins to wear off, as it would,
yeah.
And you lose the election.
Yeah.
I mean, how I can't imagine how painful that was. Well,
it is amazing
for a man that you love.
Yeah, it's amazing that he even talks to me, because I took over the political director job. We were at like 79.
Oh boy!
And I drove him to 43. So
well,
anyway, as Mary Madeline is famous for saying, we couldn't believe we lost to that draft dodging, pot smoking, philandering son of a gun. You know.
I remember that quote.
Yeah, I did. I do too. Anyway,
she probably did the tweaker.
It was depressing because it was beyond.
You admire it.
It's great working in the White House. I mean, it's awesome for anybody to work.
Yes.
But to work in the White House with someone that you loved and admired and become family, it was depressing and scary for the, in my mind, for the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feared for our country, and I had no idea what I was going to do. And
so how did you, sorry to interrupt
sure.
you, so how the transition
right.
to the Clinton administration,
yep.
was that difficult or smooth? Or
it was very smooth. It all turned, so we're all kind of depressed, you know.
Yes.
And the weekend before Thanksgiving, in November of 88, the president calls me on a Friday and said, listen, I'm going to have a formal press conference in the East Room on Monday at 9. Would you call all the old timers around the, regardless of rank, the old bushies, and tell them I want them to be there? And you don't say why. You say yes, sir. Right? It was so weird because press conferences, they weren't invited. And it wasn't. You didn't have staff or anything there. So I said yes, sir. So call around, make sure everyone I could get should be there was there. And we get be there by 8:30 or 8:30, and you know it's roped off, and it's a very official looking press conference. And never happened before during the Bush administration, at least. And it, right at 8, 9 o'clock on the button, ruffle and flourishes, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, and in walks Dana Carvey, who is a big impersonator of Bush, and the President, and they did about a 30-minute stand-up comedy routine. It was hilarious.
Oh, my God.
Excuse me. It was hilarious. But the message was, get over it.
Life will go on.
We lost. You know, think of yourselves and move on. And that's, I'm going to cry. That just George H.W. Bush and his life. It was, I get to tell you, it's a good snapshot of the difference between today and then. Because Dana Carvey was on Saturday Night Live.
Making fun of the president.
Making fun of it. But making fun of it in a Will Rogers-esque way, if you will. And today you watch these comedians, and they're nasty.
Tearing people down.
Tearing. Whether it be George W. Bush, they're kind of soft on Obama, in my opinion. But they were tough on Clinton, and I think they're just downright nasty to this president.
Yes.
Whether you like them or not, I'm not.
Yes.
That's not the point. The point is, and when you, I have this tape at home, of course, and I watch it whenever I'm, you know, need a cheer up, and you realize.
How did the president feel about the impressions?
Loved him.
Oh, did he?
Yeah,
were very funny.
And then he got there. Carvey became the president. And then Bush became Carvey. So it was Bush doing Carvey doing Bush, you know. It's really great. It's one of the things, everyone's depressed, and you needed a laugh.
Yeah, it was perfect.
It probably wasn't as hysterical, really, as we thought it was then.
Yeah.
But people on the floor,
yeah,
they needed it.
Well, and those smooth transitions have continued to this day.
And he insists upon it. You know, I was political director, so that my Democratic counterpart was Rahm Emanuel.
Wow. For the past year, you're locked in a battle to the death, and now he's walking in, and the president has told you you're going to cooperate and do everything.
Yeah. And we did, and they were great. And quite frankly, the Mondale folks were great to us when he came in
to be vice president.
And that's who he is. I mean, good administrations are ones that monitor and feel like the president. that his, yep. that his yep. imprimatur, you can feel it.
And most recently, President Obama remarked of how cordial President Bush was to yep. him, and how President Obama then did that with the current president, President yep. Trump.
It's
continued.
It's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
It's the way it's
yeah.
supposed to be.
So, no surprise, being a kid from Massachusetts, that you were very supportive in Mitt Romney's presidential campaign.
Right.
Newly elected senator from Utah. Congratulations.
Thank you. I was out there election night. It was fun.
I'm sure it's very exciting.
It was very exciting. Good for America, if I could say. He's the second coming of John Quincy Adams. You know, John Quincy Adams had three careers. First as Secretary of State, considered one of the most successful Secretaries of State in history. Then President of the United States.
Yep.
And then went to Congress after losing re-election.
Yep.
Went to Congress and I gave this book to Mitt. It's a book, an older book about Quincy, as his friends call him. And I said, that this is why you should run for the Senate, because you have a lot to give back, in my opinion. Anyway.
Do you remember the book that you gave him?
I do, like, not today. No.
Was it the biography on John Quincy Adams?
It was an older biography on John Quincy Adams.
Yeah.
And I'm from Quincy, Mass., so
yep.
Home of the Adams Boys. Only city in America with two presidents.
And so the Romney presidential campaign.
Which one?
Two campaigns.
Yeah.
Came very close, very close. A lot of Republicans disappointed he didn't win. What was that like?
Because I from Massachusetts, helped him in his governor's race in 2002. And,
yep.
You know, I feel blessed. I've two men I've worked for in my life. One is a staffer, George Herbert Walker Bush. And one is a friend and volunteer. I mean, I sold my business and was on a road with him for 6 years.
Yep.
And no one ever asked me, why'd you work for them? You know, two great Americans who just terrific people and cared a great deal. And they're kind of the classic founding father types who really felt that they had a great life and they wanted to give back and felt they had something to give.
Yes.
So they're both great. They're both a lot of fun. I was a different role because I didn't have a lot of line responsibility mm-hmm. as a kind of friend of the, and he had a lot of folks who hadn't worked in national campaigns. So I was a true advisor in many respects.
And when was his first presidential? What year it was?
2008.
2008.
We lost in the primary to McCain, if you remember.
Right.
Came close to that one, too.
And then 4 years later, he ran again as the nominee.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. But we lost McCain in Florida. But it was great both times because he's just a great person to be with. And he's a lot of fun. And people don't realize a lot of times the public perception of these men and women are so different than realities.
Yes.
The one you think is a really nice guy, whatever, can be a no good son of a gun.
Yep.
And one you think is stiff or whatever.
Yep.
Hilarious. And both Romney and 41 keep the religion on the sleeve. You know, they're these very decent, honorable people. And both hilarious. 41 is both pranksters. I mean, My favorite day in the campaign trail with 41 was the day I got to short sheet him in a hotel in St. Louis, but that's something else.
You did it?
Yeah. I hadn't done it several times almost, but the Secret Service agent would always, on duty, would always catch me and say, not on my watch. Not on my watch.
Yeah.
But anyway,
that's great.
Yeah, that's great. But anyway.
And so Mitt Romney is he's a newly elected senator from Utah.
Right.
Very exciting.
It is. It's good for the country.
It's good for the Senate.
Yeah. I think everyone thinks that way.
Yeah.
He's not going to be an attack dog on Trump. Yep. He's going to call him out when he thinks that they disagree.
Yeah.
But he's going to do it in a respectful way. And I it's going to be interesting to see what happens these next 2 years.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Now, did you see, talking about the real Mitt Romney,
did you
see the documentary?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. What did you think of that?
There's a backstory to it, but it was good.
What's the backstory?
Good, and you? the fellow did it, a friend of the son's, did one in 80, after the 08 campaign.
Okay.
That we spiked, because we didn't like the way it came out. And this one, Mitt said afterwards, you can't spike this one because I'm going to let this one out. And it was great. And I can't tell you how many people would say to all of us, if you'd only done that video at the beginning of the campaign versus the end, he may have been president.
Yeah.
You know, he did a lot.
Yeah,
you know?
I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah.
And I think you can find it, for those listening, on Netflix.
Yeah.
Do you remember the title? I don't remember.
It's just called Mitt, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, is that, yeah.
I think,
okay.
Yeah.
For young people that may be listening, we're told, I don't. This producer over here tells me that there's a lot of young people that listen. I don't know how they figure this out, but that's what they tell us. So, young people in college, we're going to give advice from you to Republicans. Hopefully, the Democrats won't hear this. Oh, only kidding. What advice you give to young people who are interested in politics or government? What do you?
I encourage it. It's a, you know, spending your life. There's lots of things you can do. I think everyone wants to live their life and look back on it and say that they've done things to make the world a better place to live, to make the country a better place to live, to make their families safer, more prosperous. And I think it's true of Republicans and Democrats. We may disagree deeply on how to do that,
yep.
But I'm a big believer that both sides have people, 90% of the people in this business are great.
Yep.
You know, I got to know Ted Kennedy very well. We fought like hammer and tong,
yep.
During the day, and yep. I respect him like crazy after hours, you know.
Yep.
So it's great. And right now, it's a tough time. People say, oh, politics now is so ugly. Why should we get in it? I say, well, you think it's tough? I always ask that question. I do a lot of colleges and stuff, which I enjoy. I say, how many here think that this is the toughest, nastiest politics ever? And usually 99%.
Correct.
I say, you know, we had a Secretary of the Treasury get shot and killed by the Vice President of the United States. That's tough politics. This is child's play. This is child's
right.
play. And because of the move, the play now, Hamilton, everyone knows that even better. But
right.
You saw
right.
all the time. I think you have to love it. And you're only successful in life, I think, if you love what you're doing. You can't be a producer if you don't like doing what you're doing. You can do yep. it, but you won't be good at it.
Yep.
And I think if you really feel the urge, and you, if you're not happy with what's going on, even more reason to do it.
Get engaged.
Yeah, get engaged. I mean, it's cyclical. And everyone thinks it's tough now. What's made it harder, I think, most of my friends on my side of the aisle and the other side, the Obama folks, blame the media for almost everything. You know, just
see, that's universal.
It's universal. But so what I think has happened, I don't blame the media. I blame the medium. When I started in politics in Boston, if I called Abe Lincoln a no-good son of a gun, back then, he'd hear about it in Springfield, Illinois, 3 months later. You're right? So now, if you're in the elevator in the Rayburn building, and I'm whispering to somebody, to you, Jim, something, and it's caught on someone's smartphone, it's on CNN within 15 minutes, and it's repeated every 5 minutes.
As if it's gospel.
As it's gospel. And then you have the rise of cable,
24-hour
TV, and it was just CNN.
Yep.
But now you have MSNBC, and you have CNN, and you have
Fox.
Yep. And they're really after audience share, and they are only speaking to a small segment, but that small segment makes the rich. So they're not newscasters. They shouldn't call themselves news people.
They're
the commentaries.
Yeah.
And it's entertainment. And it is the biggest single problem. If you watch Hannity, if you watch Rachel Maddow, they're both bright, articulate people, and you think you're living in two different worlds. And they're so they make it so personal and so nasty.
Yeah.
Not just them, by the way. I mean, it's just
single, yeah, and it's on all day and all night.
All day and all night long.
It's continuous.
And Republican conservatives will watch Fox and liberal Democrats will watch MSNBC and nothing else.
And they just get fired up.
Get fired up and distorted and whatever. And the hard part, I think, is you have a reporter for the I won't mention names, but the Washington Post. And they're reporters, and they're covering the news. And they write a column. They write a piece on what's happened as a reporter reporting on it. And they do that, and then that night they go on TV because they're paid a little bit by MSNBC or Fox, depending on their lean, to talk about it. And then they're commenting, right? So you listen to the reporter at night commenting, then you read his piece as a reporter in a Post the next morning, and he's colored it in a way it shouldn't be. and it makes it very hard, I think, to do it right.
Yep.
And I don't know how you put that genie back in the box, because these guys don't make much money in the print media.
To begin with.
They make more in electronic.
Yep.
So I'm not criticizing per se. I'm just commenting on the fact it makes the game hotter.
Yep. So would you think it's better to get your start if you're kind of open working on a campaign or in government?
Great question. It depends what you want to do. I wouldn't change my...
Whatever
I've done, I've had fun and I've enjoyed it. I loved every minute. It got me in trouble sometimes. I remember when my first week in the White House, my hometown paper, the Quincy Ledger, did, you know, a day in the life of a hometown boy type of thing. Who would ever believe this guy could work in the White House type story? You know, and...
Didn't you quite, when you were working in the White House, think that someone was going to tap you on the shoulder and be like, oh, Ron, okay, the joke's over. You got to, here you are, you're working in a supermarket. And a few years later, you're working in the White House overseeing hiring all the personnel.
Well, Jim, it's with every day, I know from the first day to the last day, I drive up to the gate at the West Wing, and the Secret Service agent say, good morning, Mr. Coffin. Come in and open the gates. I'd say, fool them again. Yeah. Holy smokes. But so it was interesting. And I never got over it. I never got over
it. I bet.
From the best days to the worst days, they're all great days.
I bet.
I remember the first day ever on the Air Force One. We're flying some. And I'm sitting in I'm used to flying coach on U.S. Air those days, but so I'm on Air Force One. Hello. And I'm sitting in my seat, and the steward comes over, Mr. Kaufman, the president wants to see you. So, of course he does. So I go up front to this court, and I'm Mr. President. So we have a little problem, political problem, I don't know, whatever that was. And said, what do you think we should do? I said, well, my advice is, he thought, I said, okay, I'll do that. And I go back to my seat, and say, holy smokes, that was the president of the United States of America. He's asking me what we should do, and God help the country, he's going to do it. You just felt that way.
Asking you on Air Force One.
Yeah, are you kidding me? I thought he was going to throw me off. I didn't know. But
that's
anyway.
Great.
So but you have to have a passion. I don't care, Jim, what you do. If you don't like doing it, change, because you're not going to be successful. And that's my experience in life. So one day that my hometown paper, after the first couple of weeks in the White House, came to write an article about shockingly hometown boy makes good. So he follows me for the day, and at the end of the day, I'm sitting in my office at maybe 9 or 10 o'clock at night. I said, boy, this has been a long day. I start early. I said, yeah, I love coming to work every day, and I hate to go home. Now, my wife loved that. She thought it was just neat. So the next morning, in the White House, and they had White House clips in those days, they sent them around. Now it's electronic, and Mrs. Bush reads everything. So, and she was another hero of mine, was Barbara Bush. And she said, oh, here's hometown boy. Read the piece. Like to come to work every morning, don't like to go home at night? Bet your wife liked that. Here's my advice. Go home right now. So I did.
That's good. Yeah, but if Barbara told you something, you're probably best to follow it.
If you had to make a mistake with the president or the first lady, no comment. Sorry, Mr. President. No comment. Okay. But 3 days later, I don't know where I'm with, again, on the plane someplace, and she says, how are things at home? In the nicest grandmotherly way,
Uh-huh.
Tough as nails. Love that woman. Miss her every day.
Yeah.
She's great.
So, Ron, you mentioned Senator Kennedy is someone on the other side of the aisle
sure.
that you admired and worked with. Anyone else?
By the way, and didn't agree with.
In any way.
Pretty much that way.
Yeah.
I got to know Kennedy the best.
And is that because of your Massachusetts connection?
Well, yeah, it was. But when 41... I'm on the board of the George Bush School of Public Service in Texas A&M. So I'm an Aggie, I guess. He decided, we had this award for the person who gives the most, and public servant type award. And sometimes it's a mayor, sometimes it's the prime minister of a foreign country. And during the first year of his son's presidency. If you may remember, Kennedy was great about helping him with education, work stuff, workfare stuff. I mean, just did a lot together.
Okay.
I think Kennedy spent more time in the Oval Office than the First Lady at the time. So the president says, I think I want to give him it was like the first award. I want to give him this big award, which was very prestigious because everyone loves 41. I said, well, our friends on the right are not going to be pleased with you for this. So anyway, so since I know the Kennedy team, I helped facilitate. He said he'd be honored to do it. 41 called to Kennedy, and Kennedy said, yeah, I'd be honored. And so it was like 6 months later. It takes, you know. And I was kind of the point person for questions from the Kennedy folks. And as he was doing the speech, the senator himself would call me and ask me questions about this and that and the other thing. And then the president asked, 41 asked me to come down a couple of days in advance and be there and stuff, which I did. And when the Kennedys arrived that day, the Kennedy was very concerned that in this very conservative school, Texas A&M, he would not be well received. And I assured him, the president assured him, that they'll be great. So they come down, and I wasn't even going to go, but they had to be here. So I meet the Kennedys and bring up the president has a, 41 has a suite at the school. And the Kennedys, they sit down. And here are two men who have talked to every group possible in the world, pretty much, right?
Yep.
They've been around, both great lions of public service. And they're both a little bit nervous. It was really interesting. I mean, and in a very sweet, wonderful way. And they both were so respectful. And then President Bush walked on stage with Ted Kennedy to make sure that, you know, and
he'd get a warm welcome.
Phenomenal. And the president made sure that when he introduced Ted Kennedy, that he said, I'm watching you all. And I'll stick Barbara on here if this is like that. Yeah. Almost. But it was great. But it was so impressive. These two men have done everything. We'd honestly be a little nervous about. It's important, clearly important to both of them, which is awesome.
Yeah,
it was awesome.
And was it a nice event?
Phenomenal. I mean, it was one of the best events I've ever been to. It was phenomenal, and obviously being a little part of it was special for me.
You work with Howard Dean and many others.
Yes. Oh.
So what's it? the shout out for Howard Dean. I heard at one of the conferences. I heard you and Mr. Dean, Governor Dean, I should say, giving an analysis of, at that time was the prior election, and boy, it was really wonderful. He seems like just a wonderful man and someone, obviously, you work closely with.
Since this is just between you and I.
Yes, we don't want your Republican colleagues hearing this.
Absolutely. I have huge respect for Governor Howard Dean. He's just a great American. You know, it's interesting about Howard. He was voted the most fiscally conservative governor 1 year during his. So he is a true conservative fiscally, and a much more, and these days moderate, because he's to the right of where his party is going these days.
Yes.
And he always gets mad at me when I say.
He doesn't like it when you say.
No. I say, you know. The person responsible for the Tea Party movement really was Howard Dean. He goes nuts. But he's just a great guy. I mean, he's a great public servant. For a younger audience, he is a very caring guy. He teaches a part-time at Yale.
Okay.
Which is, you know, a bastion of communist thought in America. And loves his kids. We talk a lot about the kids we work with over the years. And when we travel together, we can't go any place where there isn't someone that he's mentored or I've mentored or, you know.
Yeah, I was very impressed with his analysis, his political analysis. Yeah. Very smart guy, very thoughtful.
Yeah.
A realist.
Wrong, but wrong.
Wrong. I didn't say on policy. I said on political analysis.
Yeah. And he's pretty open. I mean, we both, this last election, we made some major mistakes, in my opinion. And we should have won seats, and could have, in my humble opinion, if we had focused more on what James Carville always said, you know, it's about the economy, stupid.
Yep.
And but
yep.
So when we get together, we're both pretty candid about
yep.
the goods and bads of both our parties.
And how long have you both been affiliated with Denton's?
Well, it's one of the reasons I came to Denton's, quite frankly.
Oh, okay.
He was here, Eric Tiedemann, who kind of runs the public policy
yes.
in the country.
He's been a guest on the show.
He was a great friend of mine and for a long, long time. He's an old bushy.
Yep.
He worked for
from Georgia.
Paul, right.
Yep.
He worked for Paul Coverdale, Senator Coverdale from Georgia.
Yep.
When he was a state senator, actually. And I've known Paul forever because he's a very close personal friend of 41's.
Okay.
So I had a, when I left office, the White House, again, as the voters decided I shouldn't be there anymore, after I came out of my funk, a good Democrat named Dan Dutko hired me, offered me a partnership in his firm, which was a boutique, very respected lobbying shop mm-hmm. here in town. They were doing about $2 or $3 million a year, but this is now, what, 93.
Okay.
And ended up going there, and it was a great experience for me, loved it. And we ran it, and it became the largest government affairs shop in town that wasn't connected to a law firm.
Wow.
We're doing almost, when I left, we're doing almost $40 million. And it was a little different. We tried to have a plethora of firms. We had a federal lobbying shop, mm-hmm. A state and local lobbying shop, mm-hmm. a PR firm, et cetera, et cetera. And it was going really well. And we all enjoyed it a lot, learned a lot from it. And left it, we sold it, and left to go work for MIT as a volunteer.
Okay.
But Eric, for the day I went there, and he was at Denton's, then McKenna Long and Aldridge offered me, come with us. And I didn't. And then after MIT lost, he said, please come here. So I came and talked to folks here and sat down with Governor Dean, who I did not know that well. And we bonded from the beginning.
So let's see if I get this straight. Denton's is trying to woo you, and they have Ron Kaufman, the from all of the Bush campaign, sit down with Governor Dean
right.
to woo you. Yeah. And it worked.
It worked, God. Well, you know, the truth is, for in this business, that the problems that people have aren't Republican problems or
right.
Democratic problems.
Right.
They're problems the firm has with government one
right.
way or the other.
Yeah, it's yeah.
And
it's entities interacting with government, and they need help.
Right.
And
having folks who've been on both sides, the aisle, who understand it, I think it's great for the client.
And with Denton's being the largest law firm on the planet, it must be they have a whole host of clients that must need you and Governor Dean's advice
fun.
And strategy.
Yeah.
It
does make it much more fun. It's a very unique firm.
Yeah.
People are great. I hesitated going to work for a law firm, thinking that they don't really understand what it's like it the way we do business.
Yes.
But because of Eric, and I give Eric all the credit, making them understand that this business is different than a law firm, but it's synergistic, and that it can work. And obviously, when you have the world's largest law firm, there are a lot of problems that American clients have overseas.
Yes.
Or overseas clients have here. So it's a perfect synergy.
Yeah.
And having a guy like Howard Dean and
yep.
to play with makes it even more fun.
And there's not a, business gets, has to interact with government. Any business is interacting with the government. Well, Ron, on that note, thank you very much. This has been a wonderful interview, and and good luck in the coming 2 years.
And I hope our young listeners get involved.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, there it is. What a great guy. Great perspective, positive, encouraging people to get involved in government and campaigns. We could talk to him for hours. What a wonderful, wonderful interview. We hope you enjoyed it. We sure did. So remember, you can subscribe and leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts. If you are an Android user, you will be happy to know that we are on Google Podcasts. You can also find us on Stitcher and Blueberry, really anywhere that podcasts are found. You can also follow us on Twitter, at The Lobbying Show. Also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/ the Lobbying Show. And if you want more insights regarding the interviews and our show, you can sign up for our weekly email newsletter, Monday Morning Coffee with the Lobbying Show. So until next Monday, have a great week.